First Samuel is where we are. First Samuel and Second Samuel were originally one book. The author was Samuel up until the point of his death, and then after that, it's believed that Nathan the prophet and Gad finished writing Second Samuel. First Chronicles 29:29. You'll see that both Nathan and Gad were ones who wrote about David's life. Three main characters in these books: Samuel, who was a judge, a priest, and a prophet; Saul, the first king of Israel; and David, the second king, a man after God's own heart. Some of the familiar features of 1 and 2 Samuel are the rise of the kingdom, the monarchy in Israel, the story of Hannah and Samuel, which we'll get right off the bat, David and Goliath, looking at that next week, Saul and the witch at Endor, the Davidic covenant, 2 Samuel chapter 7, where God made this covenant with David, and then the sin of David with Bathsheba. 1 Samuel starts with the birth of Samuel and ends with the death of King Saul. And 2 Samuel covers the reign of David. So we're looking at half of 1 Samuel tonight. So we'll be looking at the birth of Samuel, and we'll carry it on into the reign of King Saul is where we're going with it. So let's go ahead and look at chapter 1 as we see the birth of Samuel, the last of the judges, a prophet, and also a priest. 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1. Now there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim, of the mountains of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, an Ephraimite. So he's living in the area of Ephraim, and he's referred to as an Ephraimite. Now, oftentimes you'd think that that would mean he was a descendant of Ephraim, right? Because if you lived in the land of Judah, you'd probably be a descendant of Judah, son of Jacob. If you lived in the land of Ephraim, you would be a descendant of Ephraim, son of Joseph, son of Jacob. But not necessarily always the case. And the reason for that is because the Levites were dispersed throughout all of the tribes. And remember, they had 48 cities in the different tribes that they lived in. And so Samuel actually, or Elkanah here, and then of course his son Samuel, was actually lived in Ephraim, but is actually a descendant of Levi. And we find that from the, remember the long genealogies in 1 Chronicles, the first 9 chapters? If you go over there, you'll see the same mini genealogy that we just looked at in verse 1 over in 1 Chronicles chapter 6, verses 33 through 38. So this helps us greatly because Samuel functions in the office of a priest. And so if we look at him as just being a guy from the tribe of Ephraim, it makes it a little bit clouded, but when we can see that he's actually a Levite, a descendant of Levi, it makes that a little bit easier to see. So verse 2 says, and he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, the name of the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children, and this created problems between the two. There's a rivalry. I don't think polygamy ever works as we look at it in the Bible. It created a rivalry. Peninnah had children. Ha ha ha, Hannah, you don't have any. And so it was something that just grated on Hannah, especially at that time. To not have any kids was a really tough deal. In verse 3, it says, this man went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Also, the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. So trying to pull some of this together, let's look first of all at the line that comes down to Elkanah. If you took it from the top left and see from Ziph, Tohu, Elihu, and so forth, that's what we just looked at, that little mini genealogy. If you go to 1 Chronicles, you find that that's going to go all the way back up to Levi. Okay, so that makes Elkanah a descendant of Levi. He had two wives, Peninnah and Hannah, and from Hannah, Samuel, who we'll be looking at tonight, was born. So that we see him, again, as a descendant of Levi. The priest at the time was a man named Eli, and he had two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. So both of those trees are going to lead back to Levi. Okay, so Eli is the current priest, and his sons were functioning as priests with him, Hophni and Phinehas, that we'll be talking about in just a little bit. Elkanah lived at Ramathaim, and that's basically Ramah, and that's 15 miles south of Shiloh. Shiloh is where the tabernacle is at this time, so that's where Eli, the priest, and his sons are. And so Elkanah, with his two wives, Peninnah and Hannah, they would go up on a yearly basis to Shiloh to offer sacrifices, and it was a time to go before the Lord. And so this was their custom. They would go on a yearly basis. When they would go, it was very difficult for Hannah because, again, Hannah didn't have any kids. Peninnah seemed to just rub it in. And so Hannah's heart was broken before the Lord as they're up there in Shiloh. And she's praying and asking God for a son specifically. And she makes a commitment to God. If you'll give me a son, then I'll give him back to you. We see that in verse 11, if you'd like to look at chapter 1, verse 11. Then she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. Now, what vow does that sound like?
Nazarite
vow, right? We read about that with Samson. So in essence, what she's saying, if you'll give me a child, I'll completely devote him to you. But really what she meant is she's going to completely give him over to the service of the Lord. And the Lord is going to answer her prayer, and she'll follow through with that commitment. That's the beautiful thing about the story of Hannah. She makes the commitment and she follows through with it. Well, as she's in anguish before the Lord and she's asking God for a son, the priest Eli is watching her, and she's over there praying, but she's not speaking out loud. Her lips are just moving, and he's looking at her like she's drunk. And he begins to rebuke her for being drunk there at the tabernacle. And she says, oh, your maidservant is not drunk. I'm just in terrible grief, and I'm asking the Lord for a son. And so Eli pronounces a blessing upon her. If you want to look at verses 17 and 18, it says, then Eli answered and said, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition which you have asked of him. And she said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. And so she's thrilled. She feels that her prayer is going to be answered, and answered it is. In verse 19, it says, then they rose early in the morning, and this is Elkanah and Hannah, and worshipped before the Lord, and returned and came to their house at Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. So it came to pass in the process of time that Hannah conceived and bore a son and called his name Samuel, saying, because I have asked for him from the Lord. Samuel's name means heard by God. And so Hannah raises him, and yearly Elkanah would go up to Shiloh, but Hannah would not. She would stay back and raise Samuel. And when the time came when Samuel was weaned, whatever age that is, I mean, is that 5 years old? Is that 3 years old? In that culture, I'm not really sure. But when it came time that he was weaned, she would take him up there and leave him in Shiloh at the tabernacle to serve the Lord and go home. And so as we come to chapter 2, we have Hannah's prayer. It says in chapter 2, verse 1, and Hannah prayed and said, my heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. And this is just her prayer of thanksgiving to God and declaring the greatness of who God is. It's often compared with Mary's song in the Gospel of Luke. Mary's song in Luke 1 referred to as the Magnificat, which is the Latin for the first word that she utters, one of the words in the line, my soul magnifies the Lord, meaning magnifying the Lord. And so it's just her prayer of thanksgiving. Look at verse 11 of chapter 2. It says, then Elkanah went to his house at Ramah, but the child ministered to the Lord before Eli the priest. And so this is where they left him. You know, and can you imagine what that would be like to have? And again, how old is he? 5 years old, let's just say. Can you imagine? You've wanted a child so bad. You get this baby boy, and now you take him up and you leave him there. Now, admittedly, it's only 15 miles away, but it's 15 miles in that culture, you know. But on top of that, it tells us, it seems what's truly implied, is that she's only going up there once a year. So she's only going to see him once a year from now on. How difficult that must have been, and how precious, again, the story of Hannah is in making that commitment and following through with it. So here is Samuel. He's totally dedicated and given over to the service of the Lord, and he becomes just a great man of God in the scriptures as he does function again as a judge and a priest and also as a prophet. And so here is the beginning of Samuel, and we're going to see him as a great man of God. Now we're going to contrast here from Samuel, who he is and who he's going to be, with Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, who are also priests. Look at verse 12. It says, "Now the sons of Eli were corrupt. They did not know the Lord." And I looked at this in different translations. The sons of Eli were corrupt. And the New American Standard says they were worthless. In the New Living Translation, it says they were scoundrels. In the NIV, it says they were wicked. In the King James, it says they were sons of Belial. That's actually the literal translation. Belial in Hebrew means wickedness. So they were sons of wickedness. They were just wicked men. And the chapter goes on to tell about how when people would bring their offerings to the Lord and they'd bring their animal sacrifices, what Hophni and Phinehas would do is they would take the best of the cuts. That looks like a New Yorker to me, you know, and take the best meat. And so the people, I mean, how would you feel about bringing your offering if it was going to be snagged by the priests and not be used in a lawful way? And so it says in verse 17 of chapter 2, "Therefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for men abhorred the offering of the Lord." And that seems to be taken two ways, and it depends upon how you look at it. Even it shows in the translations as well, as you consult different translations. It's either a reference to Hophni and Phinehas, "The sin of the young men," referring to them, "was very great before the Lord, for men," referring to Hophni and Phinehas, "that they despised the offering of the Lord." They didn't care about it. You know, they just saw meat coming and they wanted it themselves. That's how many of the newer translations translate that. But others look at it that because of their abuse of the offerings, the men who were bringing the offerings despised the offering of the Lord. In other words, and that both of those kind of make sense. Obviously, Hophni and Phinehas despised the offerings, but the ones who are bringing them, they're thinking, why am I bothered doing this? These guys are just taking advantage of me. And it shows really how important the men of God were at that time, and I think to our day today, in representing God. This is the priests, you know, they are the go-between God and the people. And so if you're representing God in a negative way and turning people away from God, you can see the application with us today, can't you? Because we as Christians represent God. You know, we bear the name of Christ. If by our lifestyle and the things that we say and do, if we're turning people away, how bad that is. On the other hand, we can have the reverse effect of drawing people, making Christianity attractive and drawing people to the Lord. And so we get a good picture of Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, just scoundrels, corrupt guys. And again, we're going to bounce back and forth a little bit. Contrast that with the faithfulness of Samuel. Now, admittedly, he's still a young lad at this time. Verse 18 says, "But Samuel ministered before the Lord, even as a child, wearing a linen ephod." So where Hophni and Phinehas are sinning, here is Samuel serving. And it goes on to say in verse 19, "Moreover, his mother used to make him a little robe and bring it to him year by year when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice." Again, how hard that would be. Well, he's a year older now. He's getting bigger. Let's make him a new robe and take it up for him. See him for a little while. Say goodbye and go home. And it must have been tough, but God blessed her. You know, she fulfilled her commitment. God blessed her, gave her three more sons, two daughters. And so her quiver is full. And Samuel ends up, again, being a great man of God. Look at verse 22. We flash back to Eli and Hophni and Phinehas. It says, verse 22, "Now Eli was very old, and he heard everything his sons did to all Israel, and how they lay with the women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of meeting." So they not only were abusing the offerings, but they were abusing the women who served at the tabernacle as well. But notice it says that Eli heard everything his sons did. Okay, so he's got a responsibility there to raise his kids, to discipline his kids. He's the priest. They're functioning underneath him. He's got a certain responsibility there that he's dropping at this time. Again, jump down to verse 26 as we contrast back to Samuel. It says in verse 26, "And the child Samuel grew in stature and in favor with the Lord and men. And so God is raising up Samuel here to be the guy that's going to be a blessing to Israel. Well, God also raises up a man of God to come to Eli and rebuke him for not being the dad that he needs to be. And he begins to predict what's going to take place to Eli and also to his household. Look at verse 29. When the man says to Eli, "Why do you kick at my sacrifice and my offering, which I have commanded in my dwelling place, and honor your sons more than me, to make yourselves fat with the best of all the offerings of Israel, my people?" Okay, so Eli, in failing to discipline his sons, are basically honoring them over God, is what he's saying. Look at verses 34 and 35. The man continues, "Now this shall be a sign to you that will come upon your two sons, on Hophni and Phinehas. In one day they shall die, both of them. Then I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. I will build him a sure house, and he shall walk before my anointed forever." And I think the immediate fulfillment of that, obviously, is going to be Samuel. But some people see in that a telescoping to the Lord Jesus Christ, who is both our high priest and also our king. Okay, so therein is the introduction to the birth of Samuel and also his faithfulness, and we get a glimpse of Hophni and Phinehas. Now, in chapter 3, we see the Lord calling Samuel. Again, Samuel is still pretty young. He is there with Eli. They're at the tabernacle. They're staying in their own rooms. It's nighttime, and Samuel hears a voice calling to him, "Samuel, Samuel." And so he gets up, and he goes into Eli's room, and he says, "Here I am, for you've called me." And Eli says, "I didn't call you. Go back to bed." And so Samuel goes back and he lies down, and then he hears the voice again, "Samuel, Samuel." So he gets up and he goes, and, "Here I am, for you called me." Eli said, "I didn't call you. Go back to bed." And so he goes back and again, "Samuel, Samuel." So Samuel gets up and goes, "Here I am, for you did call me." And Eli perceived that God was speaking to Samuel. So verse 9 of chapter 3, "Therefore Eli said to Samuel, 'Go lie down, and it shall be, if he calls you, that you must say, Speak, Lord, for your servant hears.' So Samuel went and lay down in his place." Now the Lord speaks to Samuel, and the Lord tells Samuel the judgment that's going to fall upon Eli and upon his sons because of the corruption that has taken place. It says in verse 12 of chapter 3, "In that day I will perform against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile and he did not restrain them." Notice the judgment is coming not only because of the sin of his sons, but because he didn't do anything about it. We know that it's the parents' responsibility, isn't it, to raise their kids, to train them, and to discipline them. And if the parents fail in doing that, if they're negligent in doing that, then they're the ones that are responsible for it. And the Bible teaches that so clearly, that parents should be bringing up their children in the ways of the Lord. And discipline is a part of bringing up your kids. You know, that's the way you train them. And I know with our kids, what we do is, as we're disciplining them, it's not punishment because, you know, you did the wrong thing, so you're going to hurt because of it. It's training, it's correction, so that you learn in the future. Because let's say at home, one of the things that happens, you know, is you can't hit one another. You've got to restrain your anger. And if you don't learn it as a kid, if you grow up as an adult and you do not know how to restrain your anger, you can end up hurting somebody or killing somebody. And that's going to land you in a lot of trouble. You're either going to go to prison or you might even be put to death for something like that. And it's true. It says in Proverbs chapter 23, verses 13 and 14, "Do not withhold correction from a child, for if you beat him with a rod, he will not die." Now, obviously, that's talking about not child abuse. We know that's wrong. The Bible teaches that that's wrong. But it's talking about punishment like spanking. If you beat him, he's not going to die. Okay, this will get his attention. "You shall beat him." Check out what it goes on to say. "You shall beat him with a rod and deliver his soul from hell." That kind of correction will help guide them and train them so that they will be delivered down the road. Just like if Eli had taken the effort to train his kids and raise them up, they could have been spared this kind of judgment that's going to fall on them because they typically would have been better kids, okay? Obvious that he dropped the ball in it. Now you're thinking, well, you know, we did the best we could and our kids ended up like this. I realize that kids have their own free will, I totally realize that. But obviously the case here is negligence. It's really pointed out. And so we don't want to be negligent in what we're doing. And so Eli recognizes that God was speaking to Samuel. So the next morning, Eli's going, well, tell me what God said to you. What did he say? And Samuel's, oh, I don't know if I want to tell him the judgment that's going to fall upon his household. And Eli said, may what he said is going to happen to me happen to you if you don't tell me what's going to happen. And so Samuel told him all that was going to take place. And Eli's response to that was, let him do what seems good to him. And so we read in verse 19, so Samuel of chapter 3 grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fall to the ground. And so God speaking to Samuel now, raising him up. Chapter 4, we've got the Philistines and Israel fighting. The first round of battle, when the Philistines come against Israel, Israel loses 4,000. And so they're overwhelmed as to what to do. So what they do is they bring the Ark of the Covenant into battle. The Ark of the Covenant was this wooden box, was overlaid inside and out with gold. It held the Ten Commandments. It represented the presence of God in a special way. And so, in essence, they're bringing God into battle with them. And so in verses 4 and 5, it says of chapter 4, so the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were with the Ark of the Covenant of God. And when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted so loudly that the earth shook. Now, I imagine at first, they've lost 4,000 men to the Philistines, wiped out in battle. Let's get the Ark of the Covenant. And I wonder if when word came back to Hophni and Phinehas, who are used to just this posh lifestyle of living off the people, that you want us to go out to war? You know, maybe they were a little nervous at first. But here they are bringing the Ark of the Covenant out, and everybody's cheering. All of a sudden, they're rock stars. You know, yay, look who's here. And they're like, yeah, we're here to save the day. Well, they go to battle again, and the Philistines have really pulled up their boots because they recognize Israel's brought their gods into battle with them. These are the same gods that defeated the Egyptians in the Red Sea. So we need to pull up everything we've got and go into battle and do the best we can. They go out and they end up wiping out 30,000 of the children of Israel, plus Hophni and Phinehas, plus they capture the Ark of the Covenant. They capture it and they take it back as spoil from the battle. And so a messenger comes from the battle to tell Eli the fate of what's taken place. We look at verses 17 and 18 of chapter 4. And it says, so the messenger answered and said to Eli, that is, Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has been a great slaughter among the people. Also, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured. Then it happened when he made mention of the Ark of God, that Eli fell off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, for the man was old and heavy, and he had judged Israel 40 years. Do you notice when news came from the battle, what affected Eli the most wasn't that his two sons died, but that the Ark of the Covenant had been captured by the Philistines? That's what seemed to send him back. It says earlier in the chapter that he was 98 years old. It sent him back. He was heavy, maybe from all the offerings his sons were bringing him. I don't know. But he goes back. He breaks his neck. So now Hophni and Phinehas are dead. Eli's dead. The Ark has been captured. And Phinehas' wife is going to die. She starts giving birth to their child. Now, maybe it sends her into labor. Okay, so she's in a point where she's giving birth and she recognizes that her father-in-law is dead, her husband's dead, the Ark has been captured. And so as she is dying, giving birth to her child, we read in verse 21, then she named the child Ichabod, saying the glory has departed from Israel because the Ark of God has been captured and because of her father-in-law and her husband. Ichabod means inglorious or no glory. The glory has departed from Israel, the Ark of the Covenant leaving. And so she names her child according to the event, no more glory in Israel. And so great devastation in Israel that day. But the Philistines have their trophy. They have the Ark of the Covenant. And so they bring it back to the land of the Philistines, chapter 5. Then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Now Ashdod is 50 miles from 50 miles from, wow, that print is small, 50 miles from Shiloh, okay? So they brought it over into Philistine territory, and it tells us in verse 2, when the Philistines took the Ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. Now, Dagon was their deity of fertility. It was represented with the face and hands of a man and the tail of a fish. Dagon, primary god of the Philistines. We read about the feast of Dagon when we were reading about Samson. Remember after they put out Samson's eyes, threw him into chains, and then they brought him out for that feast of Dagon that was taking place. And that's where Samson was able to take hold of the two pillars and knock them down. 3,000 were killed that day. We also will read about the house of Dagon when Saul, the first king of Israel, ends up dying on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines come and they chop off his head and they strap his body to the wall of Beth-shan and they take his head. It's the First Chronicles passage that tells us that his head is fastened into the house of Dagon as a trophy at that time. So there's references to Dagon. But here they've taken the Ark of the Covenant of God and they've brought it into the house of their god, the house of Dagon, as spoil. We've captured their god. Verse 3, and when the people of Ashdod arose early in the morning, there was Dagon fallen on its face to the earth before the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and set it in its place again. And so their statue of their god has fallen prostrate before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, before God. And so what do they do for their god? They go and they pick him up and put him on his pedestal again. Verse 4, and when they arose early the next morning, there was Dagon fallen on its face to the ground before the Ark of the Lord. The head of Dagon and both the palms of its hands were broken off on the threshold. Only Dagon's torso was left of it. And so now he's fallen. His head is broken off. His hands have broken off because God is supreme, even though he's in Philistine territory. Amen? And so God begins to plague those of the Philistines with, some say tumors, some interpret it as hemorrhoids, some say the bubonic plague. They begin to be plagued. In some translations, rats are going through. You know, it's something that God is bringing upon them, or at least they think the God of Israel is bringing this upon them. And so they take the Ark of the Covenant and they get it out of Ashdod, and they send it over to another Philistine city, which is one of the primary five cities of the Philistines, over to Gath. But the same thing starts happening at Gath, and so they send it over to Ekron. And so they take it from, here's a little bit larger of a print of this, from Shiloh they went to battle around Ebenezer, the Ark was captured, take it to Ashdod. Problems in Ashdod with the plague. They send it to Gath. They send it up to Ekron. Like all of the Philistine cities are being plagued because of the Ark of the Covenant. Verse 6 of chapter 5, the hand of the Lord was heavy on the people of Ashdod, and he ravaged them and struck them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And chapter 5 continues on to say how they moved it from place to place, and God continued to plague the people at that time. And so they come up with the idea. They look to their priests and their diviners. What should we do? And so they direct them to take the ark and to send it back to Israel and to put it on a cart, let it be drawn by two milk cows that have two calves. Keep the calves at home and send the milk cows. And if these guys just turn around and come back to their calves, which would be the natural thing to do, then, you know, this was just happenstance. But if they go against nature and go back to Israel, then we know that God's hand, or the God of Israel's hand, has been upon us in this dealing. Look at chapter 6, beginning from verse 8, as they continue telling the lords of the Philistines what to do. That is, their priests and diviners. Then take the ark of the Lord, set it on the cart, put the articles of gold which you are returning to him as a trespass offering in a chest by its side. Then send it away and let it go and watch. If it goes to the road to its own territory, to Beth Shemesh, then he has done us this great evil. But if not, then we shall know that it is not his hand that struck us. It happened to us by chance. Well, what ends up happening is the cows make a beeline over to Beth Shemesh. And the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh are thrilled that the Ark of the Covenant has come back into Israel. But they make a grave mistake by opening up the Ark of the Covenant and looking inside of it, something that they shouldn't do. And so God strikes the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh for looking into the Ark. And so now it's taken to a place called Kirjath Jearim. And the people in chapter 7 now recommit their lives to the Lord. They haven't been walking uprightly before the Lord, obviously, and now they recommit themselves to the Lord in chapter 7, acknowledging their sin. Look at chapter 7, verse 4. It says, "So the children of Israel put away the Baals and the Ashtoreths and served the Lord." The Philistines attack again. God fights for Israel, gives them the victory, I think because they're walking uprightly before the Lord now. Chapter 7, verse 12, it says, "Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shen and called its name Ebenezer, saying, 'Thus far the Lord has helped us.'" Ebenezer means a stone of help. It was a memorial stone. And so this stone is to remind us that God has helped us in our battles, so that when we go through future battles, we can look back at this memorial stone here and remember how God had helped us. And we sing that song, and it helps us to understand the wording in that song that we sing. "Here I raise my Ebenezer, hither by thy help I'm come, and I hope by thy good pleasure safely to arrive at home. Here I raise my Ebenezer, my memorial stone, how God has helped me in the past get through this. And so for the future, I hope by thy good pleasure safely to arrive at home." I'm basing my hopes upon the past. I'm basing my hope for the future upon how you've helped me out in the past. And so the stone of help, the Ebenezer, the memorial stone. So now the land knows peace for a time because the people have their lives right with God and God has brought them this victory. Samuel has a circuit. He goes on the end of chapter 7, verses 15 through 17. Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. He went from year to year on a circuit to Bethel, Gilgal, Mizpah, and judged Israel in all those places. But he always returned to Ramah, for his home was there. There he judged Israel, and there he built an altar to the Lord. This brings us to chapter 8, where Israel requests a king. Up to this time, Israel has been judged by various judges that God would raise up to deliver them for whatever trouble they got themselves into. But God was always their king. Now Israel wants to see a king with skin on. And this is something that's going against what God wants them to do, but they want to do it anyway. They want to be like all the other nations. And so we're introduced to Saul as we come into these next few chapters. In chapter 8, we find that Samuel's sons aren't going to do that great a job following in their dad's footsteps, which is very extremely unfortunate. In verse 3 of chapter 8, it says, "But his sons," referring to Samuel, "did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, 'Look, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations.'" Just stopping for a moment, it's kind of sad, isn't it? I mean, here you've got Eli, a man of God, and when you read about him, he seems to be a pretty good priest, except for the fact that he was negligent in raising his kids. And what we read about Samuel through the chapters we've just been skimming through, he seemed to be a great guy, and yet his sons are not turning out good either. And it just makes you stop and kind of go, what's going on here? You know what I mean? Admittedly, everybody has their own free will, but I wonder sometimes if you get too caught up in what you're doing and forget that these little guys at home, they need direction. I don't know. You know, it just makes you stop and wonder. Here's some pretty decent examples, and here's some kids that are just going astray. And so it's worth taking a moment and looking at closely and going, what's going on with this? So anyway, in a sense, it's kind of understandable. If we're left with your son, Samuel, it's not going to turn out real well for us. So they want a king. However, on the other hand, God had always been their king, and they're looking to divert from that. And so God will instruct Samuel to give them a king. In verse 7 of chapter 8, the Lord said to Samuel, "Heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they've not rejected you, but they've rejected me, that I should not reign over them." Verse 9, "Now therefore heed their voice, however you shall solemnly forewarn them, and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them." And so Samuel proceeds to tell him, "You're going to get a king, but the king's going to take your sons, and he's going to take your daughters, and he's going to take your lands, and he's going to take your servants, because he needs his army, and he needs his army to be fed and tended to. And so he's going to take all of this from you if you have a king." But the people would not budge. They continued to persist in asking for a king. Look at verse 19 of chapter 8. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, "No, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." And so that's what they want. This is what God gives them. We're introduced to Saul now in chapter 9. We get a picture of what he's like in verse 2. He's the son of Kish. And speaking of Kish in chapter 9, verse 2, it says, "He had a choice and handsome son whose name was Saul. There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people." Tall and handsome. You can see this is where the Bible miniseries got just a little bit wrong, because Saul didn't come across as the most handsome man in the pack there. But this guy is very good looking, and he's tall. He's king material, according to the outward appearance. But God doesn't judge according to the outward appearance. He judges according to the heart. God is going to give them, Saul, recognize God is giving them what they're asking for. They want a king that's like all the other nations. So in chapter 9, we're introduced to Saul. He's out looking for his father's donkeys. They can't find him. They go, "You know, I heard there's a prophet over in this town," referring to Samuel. So they go over there to get some directions from them. Saul has this great feast taking place. God lets Samuel know that Saul is the one who's going to be the next king of Israel. And so Samuel anoints Saul and gives him specific signs that will take place to confirm the fact to Saul that he is to be the next king. Look at chapter 10, verse 1. It says, "Then Samuel took a flask of oil and poured it on his head and kissed him and said, 'Is it not because the Lord has anointed you commander over his inheritance?'" And so God changes Saul's heart. Verse 9, look at this. "So it was when he had turned his back to go from Samuel that God gave him another heart. And all those signs came to pass that day." And so God is preparing him to be able to stand up to the challenge of being the king of Israel. And hopefully, again, Saul has his own free will. Hopefully Saul will choose to be obedient to the Lord and follow after him. Saul is then presented to the people at the end of chapter 10. Samuel calls all of the people together. Samuel says, "You wanted a king? Here is your king. He's going to be from the tribe of Benjamin. He's going to be from the family of Kish. And here is your king, King Saul." And the people look for their king. Verse 22. They sought him. They couldn't find him. Verse 22 of chapter 10. "Therefore they inquired of the Lord further, 'Has the man come here yet?' And the Lord answered, 'There he is, hidden among the equipment.'" So this is their powerful king that's going to deliver them. The guy who, and it's a good sign, a guy who's kind of reserved, kind of shy in the beginning. A guy who could be humble with that kind of a trait, but he ends up becoming very proud. So he's hiding among the equipment at this big revealing of who the king is. Verse 23, "So they ran and brought him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. And Samuel said to all the people, 'Do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? That there is no one like him among all the people.' So all the people shouted and said, 'Long live the king.'" Verse 26, check that out. "And Saul also went home to Gibeah, and valiant men went with him whose hearts God had touched." And so God touched the hearts of those who would support Saul and be there for him, to back him as the king. And Saul, he gets his first test in the next chapter. Now that he's the king, he's called upon to help those that are in need. In chapter 11, we read about Nahash and the Ammonites. Over in Ammonite territory, this is east of the Jordan River, they come to conquer those in Jabesh-Gilead, which is Israelite territory at the time. And so as the Ammonites come to Jabesh-Gilead, those in Jabesh-Gilead say, "You know, why don't you make a covenant with us?" And what that meant was, "We'll pay you money, we'll pay you tribute if you don't beat us up and take our land." And so the Ammonites said, "Tell you what, this will be our covenant with you. Each one of you is going to have your right eye put out." And those in Jabesh, and you got to realize that when you lose an eye, you lose your depth perception. So it's going to be hard to fight in war. Also, if it's your right eye, you know, you got to look around the shield a little bit farther and you become more of a target for the enemy, all right? So they say, give us 7 days and we'll get back with you. And so they go and they call for Saul and Israel to see if they will come over and give them the support they need. And this is exactly what Saul does. He's able to come and he's able to muster an army of 330,000 people. They come over and they conquer the Ammonites. So it's the first big victory under Saul's belt. And so they go down to Gilgal, and basically this is like the coronation of the king. Verse 14 of chapter 11, Samuel said to the people, "Come, let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there." So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they made sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. So it's an amazing start for Saul, great victory under his belt. But now Samuel admonishes the people to obey the Lord. He really lays it out for them. He said, you know, in the past when you were in trouble, you cried out, God raised up a king. And he mentions Gideon. He mentions those that God raised up to be able to deliver them and how God was their king and how he would bring judges to assist them. He says, but now you want a king like the other nations. So God wants you to know that you've asked for the wrong thing. And so God in his judgment sent thunder and rain at the time of the harvest to bring judgment upon them. And it really woke the people up. Verse 14 of chapter, or verse 19 of chapter 12 says, and all the people said to Samuel, pray for your servants to the Lord your God that we may not die, for we have added to all our sins the evil of asking a king for ourselves. Verse 20, then Samuel said to the people, do not fear. You have done all this wickedness, yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. And so they recognize they've done the wrong thing, and they did the right thing in saying, in essence, we have sinned. We made a mistake in asking for a king. And I think that's all God really wanted to hear. You know, okay, you acknowledge you did the wrong thing. And so Samuel says, you know what, just serve God with your whole heart. Now, you kind of are where you are now, but just give him your whole heart. And so we come into chapter 13, and they're battling the Philistines again. But it's tough. They're being outnumbered by the Philistines, and Saul's army is starting to disperse. They're hiding in caves. Some of them are defecting out of there, and Saul doesn't know what to do. He's losing his army. Samuel isn't around. Samuel had specifically told him, wait for me till the seventh day. And when I come, I'll offer the sacrifice. It's like seeking God's blessing upon the battle. And so the seventh day has come, and Samuel has not arrived. And so Saul takes matters into his own hands to offer the sacrifice himself. Saul is not a priest. He can't do that. So it's an unlawful sacrifice, a wrong thing to do. So chapter 13, verse 8, it says, then he waited 7 days, according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal. And the people were scattered from him. So Saul said, bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me. And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering that Samuel came. Isn't that always the way it is, you know? You almost waited long enough, but not quite. And so Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him that he might greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? Saul said, when I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore, I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering. What Saul should have said was, Samuel, I got scared, I got impatient, I sinned, I did the wrong thing by offering the sacrifice. Will you forgive me? Will God forgive me for this? But what he did is he proceeded to blame the people. The people were scattering. And then he blamed Samuel. And you didn't come when you said you did. Well, I guess you did. But, you know, you didn't come when you said you did, according to my timetable. And then the Philistines, I mean, they were going to come and womp on us. So we did what we did, making excuses. Verse 13, and Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart. And the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. Who's the man after God's own heart that he's seeking? It's David, right? See, to be a man after God's own heart, this was the theme of our men's retreat this year. To be a man after God's own heart means to be a man that will be obedient to the Lord. And Saul was, you know, the complete opposite of that. He was unwilling to do what God had directed him to do and to follow after God's ways and his decrees. And so God can't use a man like that. And so he's going to raise up David, a man who will be willing to obey God, to obey him in doing the right thing and to be an obedient person when he's done the wrong thing. Even when David sinned, he didn't try and blame the other people. It's her fault, you know. He said, I have sinned. And so God was able to forgive him. He still suffered all the consequences, the human consequences, but God was able then to continue to use him. And that's a man or a woman after God's own heart, somebody who's willing to be obedient to the Lord and to follow after him. And so Saul has just proven that he is not the kind of guy that God can use. So Samuel leaves. Israel is left to face the Philistines. In chapter 14, they continue to battle the Philistines. We're introduced to Jonathan. Jonathan is just an amazing man. He's the son of King Saul. It says in chapter 14, verse 6, then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of those uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. So his armor bearer said to him, do all that is in your heart. Go then, here I am with you according to your heart. So Jonathan and his armor bearer go against 20 Philistines that are up on a rocky plateau, the garrison of the Philistines, and they're able to take them all out. He was a man that was a lot like David. In fact, David and Jonathan's hearts were knit together as close friends. And so the battle would continue on. Saul would make a foolish vow. Nobody's supposed to eat today. If you eat, you're going to be put to death. Well, Jonathan doesn't hear the vow. He ends up eating. And so Saul wants to kill his own son for breaking a vow that he didn't even hear made. You know, and so the army steps in and able to intervene. And Jonathan isn't put to death. That brings us to chapter 15, where we're going to close it tonight. Chapter 15, verse 1, Samuel also said to Saul, the Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people, over Israel. Now, therefore, heed the voice of the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have, and do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. So Saul gathered the people together and numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. Now this is one of those hard sayings of the Bible where God is directing his people to go and utterly wipe out the Amalekites in this case. We understand the men, they're the soldiers. Maybe we can understand the women a little bit, but when you get to the children, the infant, the nursing child, all of a sudden we go, how do we make sense of this? And thankfully, we're just about out of time, so we don't really have to go into that tonight. No. There are some conjectures that seem to make a little more sense with it, which we'll, you know, we might save it for that comment time afterwards if you guys would like to talk about that. But what we fall back on is we know God is just. You know, we fall back in faith on the fact that he is just. And it's his judgment coming upon a people group that has turned and has viciously attacked his people, okay? And they would be perennial enemies of Israel, and they would continue to plague Israel. In fact, you get up to the book of Esther, and you find a connection with Haman, who wants to utterly exterminate the Jews connected with the Amalekites, okay? So there's conjecture that we could put in on this, and maybe, you know, what about the kids? Well, they're not going to have any moms or dads to raise them. You know, are they going to rise up and go, well, you guys put my parents to death, we're going to attack you? I mean, there's a lot of conjecture that can go with it. I think the easiest thing to do is to fall back again on the fact that God is just in what he does when he judges. And the point that I wanted to make in making sure we read that is the direction that Saul got was to utterly wipe out everyone and everything, every person and every animal was to be exterminated. And so Saul went on the mission. Verse 9 of chapter 15, it says, "But Saul and the people spared Agag," which was the king, "and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were unwilling to utterly destroy them." Notice the word unwilling. They were unwilling to utterly destroy them. "But everything despised and worthless, that they utterly destroyed." And so Samuel is going to come and he's going to confront Saul. In verse 12 it says, "So when Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul, it was told Samuel, saying, 'Saul went to Carmel, and indeed he set up a monument for himself. And he has gone on a round, passed by, and gone down to Gilgal.'" The kind of guy that goes and puts up a monument for himself is not the kind of guy that God can use. You can see the pride that is filled in Saul's heart. Verse 13, "Then Samuel went to Saul, and Saul said to him, 'Blessed are you of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord.' But Samuel said, 'What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear?' And Saul said," notice carefully, "'They have brought them from the Amalekites. For the people," that's his army, he's the king, that's his army, "'for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord," notice, not the Lord my God or the Lord our God, "but to the Lord your God. And the rest," noticed, "we have utterly destroyed." See, he includes himself in that group that did what they were supposed to do. Okay? "We've utterly destroyed everything else, but the people," the soldiers who are under my command, "they brought back these offerings and so forth, and to sacrifice to the Lord your God." Then Samuel said to Saul, "Be quiet," verse 16, "and I will tell you what the Lord said to me last night." And he said to him, "Speak on." "So Samuel said, 'When you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel? Now the Lord sent you on a mission and said, "Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord?" And Saul said to Samuel, "But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me, and brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took of the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best of the things," notice, "which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal." Notice the kind of heart that Saul has. He's not the kind of guy that'll say, "You know what, Samuel, I again did the wrong thing. I did what was best in my own eyes. I should have done what you said to do. I didn't do it. I have sinned." I think God would have worked with that. I think God would have said, "You have sinned, but I've pardoned your sin." That's what he did with David, you know. But he blamed other people. "It's not my fault. It's the people's fault. And, you know, they're the ones who did it. And I'm in the group that, you know, did the wiping out of everybody, and they didn't do it. But we've obeyed God, basically, in all that we said. We brought back these sacrifices." And that's the key thing, trying to say that all of this we brought back is so that we can give it to God and sacrifice it to him. And that's where in verse 22 it says, "So Samuel said, 'Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you've rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king.'" God's delight is not in the sacrifices that you've unlawfully brought back, but God's delight is in your obedience. And so what he's trying to do is he's trying to appease God. Saul is. He's trying to appease God in the midst of his disobedience by going, "Oh, here, God, these are for you." And God, Samuel is saying that God doesn't care about your religious ritual. If your life is not in obedience to me, you're not going to appease him in another way. And the way we see that in our world today, in our lives today as Christians, if we live a life of disobedience but go, "You know what, I'm going to tithe to my church and I'm going to go to church and that'll make God happy." Do you think it's going to make God happy? I think it's really clear in this passage what makes God happy, and that is obedience. A man or a woman after his own heart is a man or a woman who is obedient to the Lord, and God is not going to be appeased by anything else that we do if we're not obedient to what he has called us to do. It's so clear as we see the heart of God here. And he likens it to verse 23. Rebellion, to be disobedient, is as the sin of witchcraft. And stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. And of course, the consequences that Saul gets here is that he can no longer be king. He's been rejected as king. Verse 24, then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your word. So it looks like he's coming around, right? He's acknowledging, I've sinned. I've transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. You see how he can't take full responsibility for it? It's because I was afraid of them. Who? Well, my soldiers there. I was afraid of them and I obeyed them. Who? Well, my soldiers. I obeyed them. See, he's passing it off again. He's not coming clean and surrender before the Lord. I did the wrong thing. I'm the one who's at fault. How do we know that? Well, look at verse 25. He wants something from it. Now, therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord. That we can go back before all my soldiers, you and me, and worship him together. Like everything's okay. That everybody will think everything's all right here. But Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you. For you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. Verse 27, and as Samuel turned around to go away, Saul seized the edge of his robe, and it tore. So Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today, and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you. And also the strength of Israel will not lie nor relent, for he is not a man that he should relent. A good object lesson there. Samuel turns to go away and Saul grabs his robe. He rips the corner and Samuel said, just like you ripped my robe, so God is ripping the kingdom right out of your hands and he's giving it to your neighbor who is better than you. Who is the neighbor? David, right? The kingdom is going to be transferred to a man who will be obedient to God. Verse 30, then he said, I have sinned. Okay, he's coming around now. I have sinned. No. He said, I have sinned, yet honor me now. Please, before the elders of my people and before Israel, and return with me that I may worship the Lord your God. So Samuel turned back after Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. This is a depressing passage anyway, as you see the life of Saul. But one of the things that is sad through it is that he just cares about saving face, it seems. Just go with me now so it looks okay in front of the people. And he's so concerned about what the people think, and so disconcerned about what God thinks about him. You know, he's losing the kingdom and he's disappointed God in not obeying him. And it's like it doesn't mean anything to him. He only cares about how he looks in front of the people. And so verse 35, as we close it out, Samuel went no more to see Saul until the day of his death. Nevertheless, Samuel mourned for Saul, and the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. And so we see that Samuel still had a heart for Saul. Even through all of that, Samuel still cared about him. And it was heavy on his heart until the day that he died. Saul goes down as another story of what could have been. Like when we went through Samson, a story of what could have been. Saul, a story of what could have been. I don't want my life to go down as a story of what could have been. I don't think you want your life to go down that way either. You know, it's about finishing well. It's about being obedient to God. I think that's the clear thing. And that's what we're going to see as we move into the life of David. As a man after God's own heart, as a man who was willing to put God first in his life and surrender to him. So next week, chapters 16 through 31, is where we'll get in. We'll be introduced to David and see the tension between David and Saul for the rest of Saul's kingship. And then God will raise up David to replace Saul as king and get into his life. Let's pray and then we'll open it up. Father, we thank you for the time we could spend in your word and the lessons that uplift us and the lessons that kind of sober us as to what we don't want to do. And I thank you for those kind of lessons. And I pray that you would help us not to follow in those kind of footsteps. And I think the key element, character trait that I see, Father, is a man and a woman who would be surrendered, transparent, and obedient before you. And when we're not, that we would be real about that, confess that, and get back in right relationship with you. Please help us to be those people, to bring honor and glory to your name, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.